There are 250 children here under the age of 12, Ari said, without introduction or preface. They will be evacuated tomorrow night. He looked at the dozen surprised faces. A task force is now assembling at Yad El Moshav, he continued. Tonight, 400 men from every settlement in the Hula will be led up the west face of the mountain by David Ben-Ami. If everything goes according to plan and they are not discovered, they should be here by daybreak tomorrow. 250 of the men will each carry a child down the mountain tomorrow night. The balance, 150 men, will act as a guard force. I may add that the guard force will be carrying all the heavy automatic weapons in the Hula Valley. Ari's listeners in the bunker stared at him as though he were insane. There was no sound or movement for a full minute. Finally, Zev Gilboa stood up. Ari, perhaps I did not understand you. You actually plan to carry 250 children down the mountain at night? That is correct.
It is a treacherous trip for a man by himself in daylight, Dr. Lieberman said. Carrying a child down at night, some of them are certain to fall.
That is a risk that has to be taken.
But Ari, Zev said, they must pass so close to Abu Yeshah. It is certain that Kasi's men will detect them.
We will take every precaution to see that they are not detected. Everyone began to protest at once.
Quiet!
Ari snapped. This is not a forum. You people here are not to speak of this to anyone. I want no panic. Now get out of here, all of you. I have a lot of work to do.
The shelling from Fort Esther was particularly heavy during the day. Ari worked with each section head in turn to complete the smallest details of the evacuation and to work out a minute-by-minute timetable. Each of those dozen people who knew of the scheme went around with hearts heavy with apprehension. 1,000 things could go wrong. Someone could slip and cause a panic. The Arab dogs in Abu Yeshah would hear them or smell them and bark. Kasi would discover the move and attack all the settlements in the Hula, realizing they were without their heavy weapons. Yet they knew that there was little else that Ari could do. In a week or 10 days, Gandafna would reach a desperation level anyhow. As evening approached, David Ben-Ami, with the task force in Yad El, sent out a coded blinker message that he would be on the way with the darkness. Throughout that second night, the 400 volunteers pushed their way up the mountain and appeared on the outskirts of Gandafna before daybreak in a state of exhaustion from the climb and the tension. Ari met them outside the village and hid them in the woods. He did not want them spotted by Kasi's men, nor did he want any wild speculation inside Gandafna. They remained in the woods through the entire day. At 6:10 in the evening, exactly 40 minutes before the sun was to set, the operation went into full effect. The children to be evacuated were fed at exactly 6:05, and a sleeping powder was put in each child's milk. By 6:15, the children were put into their bunks in the water pipe shelters beneath the ground. They were led in group singing until they dropped off into a deep, drugged slumber. At 6:32, the sun set behind Fort Esther. At 6:40, Ari called a meeting of the entire staff outside of the children's bunkers.
You will all pay strict attention, he said sternly. In a few minutes, we are going to begin the evacuation of the younger children. Your name will be called, and you will be given an assignment. Everything has been worked out on a tight schedule, and any variation of it could endanger the lives of the children and their escorts as well as yourselves. I want no discussion or questions. Any failure to cooperate will be dealt with drastically.
At 6:45, Yordana Ben Canaan set out a guard around Gandafna, consisting of the rest of the children. The guard was 4 times normal strength to make certain there would be no Arab infiltration that might discover the movements inside Gandafna. Zev Gilboa and his 20 Palmach troops attached to Dafna pushed out toward the hills on a special covering mission. As soon as the security around Gandafna was reported tight, 25 of the Gandafna staff went into the bunkers to dress the sleeping children in their warmest clothing. Kitty moved from child to child to make certain that each one had been properly drugged by the sleeping powder. A thick strip of adhesive tape was placed over each child's mouth so that he could not cry out in his sleep. By 7:30, the unconscious children were dressed and ready. Ari then brought the task force from its hiding place in the woods. A chain line was formed from the bunkers, and the sleeping little bodies handed out one by one. Improvised strap rigs had been sewn together to form a makeshift saddle seat for the back of the men so that the children could be carried like packs. This would allow each man to have both hands free for his rifle and the climb. By 8:30, the 250 men and their small slumbering loads stood a final check to see that the children were strapped in securely. Then the line moved out to the main gate, where the protecting force, 150 men with automatic weapons, stood ready. With Ari leading the way, they pushed off over the edge of the drop down the side of the mountain. One by one, the men and the children dropped down until the last of them disappeared into the night. Those left behind stood at the gates of Gandafna in silence. There was nothing to do now but wait until morning. They began drifting back toward their bunkers, where they would spend the sleepless night in silence, trembling with fear for the children and for the fate of this strange convoy. Kitty Fremont stood alone by the main gate for more than an hour after they had gone. She stared vacantly into the darkness.
"It is going to be a very long night," a voice said behind her. "You might as well get in out of the cold."
Kitty turned. Jordana stood next to her. For the first time since they had met, Kitty was actually glad to see the red-headed Sabra. She had been developing a growing admiration for Jordana since her decision to stay. Jordana was perhaps the one person most responsible for keeping Gandafna calm. The girl had instilled the young Gadna troops with an infectious confidence. They behaved like spirited battle veterans. During all the ordeals since the closing of the road, Jordana had remained contained and efficient. It was quite a load for a young woman not yet 20, but Jordana had that quality of leadership that made those around her feel secure.
"Yes, it's going to be a very long night," Kitty said. "Then we can keep each other company," Jordana said. "I will tell you a secret. I have a half bottle of brandy hidden in the command post bunker. I think that tonight would be a perfect time to finish it. Why don't you wait for me at my bunker? I have to bring in the guards. I'll be back in a half hour."
Kitty didn't move. Jordana took her arm.
"Come on," she said gently. "There is nothing we can do now."
Kitty had been sitting nervously and smoking cigarette after cigarette until Jordana finally got back to the command post. Jordana took the brown Haganah stocking cap from her head, and her long scarlet tresses fell to her shoulders. She alternately held her cheeks and rubbed her hands together to drive out the cold. The brandy was hidden in a loosely filled place in the dirt wall. She took it out, wiped off the bottle, and poured Kitty and herself a stiff drink.
"L'chaim," Jordana said, taking a sip. "That is good. How long will it be before they pass near Abu Yasha?"
"That won't be until after midnight," Jordana answered.
"I have been telling myself over and over that they are going to come through all right. Then I begin thinking of the thousands of things that can go wrong."
"It is impossible not to think about it," Jordana said. "But it is in the hands of God now."
"God?" "Yes. He does special things here," Kitty said. "If you don't get religion in Palestine, I doubt that you'll get it anywhere," Jordana said. "I cannot remember the time that we have not lived on faith. We actually have little else to sustain us."
Coming from Jordana ben Canaan, the words sounded strange, yet not strange at all.
On the surface, Yordana did not appear to harbor a deep faith. But what else could give her the power to exist under this constant tension if it were not faith?
Kitty, Yordana said suddenly, I have a confession to make to you. I have wanted very much for us to become friends.
Why is that, Yordana?
Because I have learned something from you. Something I have been very wrong about. I have watched you work here with the children, and I know what you did for Ari. When you decided to stay, I realized something. I realized that a woman like you can have just as much courage as our kind of people. I used to believe that to be feminine was a sign of weakness.
Thank you, Yordana. Kitty smiled weakly. But I'm afraid I could use a little of your brand of faith or courage or whatever it is right now. I feel as though I'm ready to fall apart.
Kitty lit a cigarette and Yordana poured her another brandy.
I have been thinking, Yordana said. You would be good for Ari.
Kitty shook her head.
We are, as the saying goes, two nice people not made for each other. That is unfortunate, Kitty.
Kitty looked at her watch. She knew from the discussions that the long column of men would now be approaching the first of the almost straight drops. With the children, they would use ropes, easing each man's descent one by one. It was a 35-foot plunge. From there, they would have to slide in loose dirt for 100 yards.
Tell me about yourself and David, Kitty said quickly.
Yordana's eyes lit up.
Ah, my David. My gentle, wonderful David. Where did you first meet?
At the Hebrew University. I met him the second day I was there. I saw him, and he saw me, and we fell in love at that very moment, and we have never fallen out of it.
That's the way it was with my husband and me, Kitty said. Of course, it took me all that first term to let him know he was in love with me.
It took me longer than that, Kitty smiled.
Yes, men can be such a bother about such things. But by summer he knew very well who his woman was. We went out on an archaeological expedition together into the Negev Desert. We were trying to find the exact route of Moses and the 10 tribes in the wildernesses of Zin and Paran.
I hear it's pretty desolate out there.
No. Actually, there are ruins of hundreds of Nabataean cities. The cisterns still have water in them. If you run in luck, you can find all sorts of antiquities.
It sounds exciting.
It is, but it's terribly hard work. David loves digging for ruins. He feels the glory of our people all around us. Like so many others. That is why the Jews can never be separated from this land. David has made wonderful plans. After the war, we are both going to return to the university. I will go for my master's degree and David his doctorate. And then we shall excavate a big, big Hebrew city. He wants to open Hazor, right here in the Hula. Of course, these are only dreams. That takes lots of money. And peace.
Then she laughed ironically.
Peace, of course, is merely an abstract word, an illusion. I wonder what peace is like. Perhaps peace would be dull for you.
I don't know,
Yordana said with a trace of tiredness in her young voice.
Just once in my life I would like to see how human beings live a normal life.
Will you travel?
Travel? No. I do what David does. I go where David goes. But, Kitty, I would like to go out once. All my life I have been told that all life begins and ends in Palestine. But every once in a while I feel strangled. Many of my friends have gone away from Palestine. It seems that we Sabras are a strange breed made for fighting. We cannot adjust to living in other places. They all come back to Palestine sooner or later.
But they grow old so quickly here.
Yordana cut herself short.
It must be the brandy, she said. As you know, Sabras can't drink at all.
Kitty smiled at Yordana and felt her first compassion for the girl. She snuffed out her cigarette and looked at her watch again. The minutes were dragging.
Where would they be now?
Still being lowered down that first cliff. It will take at least 2 hours to get them all down. Kitty sighed weakly, and Yordana stared into space.
What are you thinking? About David? And children? That first summer on the desert, we found a graveyard more than 4,000 years old. We managed to uncover a perfect skeleton of a little child. Perhaps it died trying to find the promised land. David looked at the skeleton and cried.
He's like that. His heart is sick day and night over the siege of Jerusalem.
I know he is going to try to do something foolish.
I know it.
Why don't you lie down, Kitty? It is going to be a long time before we know anything.
Kitty finished her brandy and stretched back on the cot and closed her eyes. In her mind, she saw that long line of men being lowered by rope with the sleeping children dangling from their backs. And then she saw flinty-eyed Arab irregulars lurking near the column, spying on their moves, waiting for them to get close and into a trap. It was impossible to sleep.
I think I'll go over to Dr. Lieberman's bunker and see how they're doing.
She put on a wool-lined jacket and walked outside. There hadn't been any shelling all evening. An alarming thought came. Perhaps Mohammed Kasi knew something and had moved most of his men out of Fort Esther. She did not like it. The moon was far too bright. The night was far too clear and quiet. Ari should have waited until a foggy night to move the children. Kitty looked up the hill and made out the outlines of Fort Esther. They must have seen, she thought. She entered one of the faculty bunkers. Dr. Lieberman and the rest of the staff all sat on the edge of their cots, staring blankly, numb with tension. Not a word was spoken. It was so morbid she could not stand it, and she went outside again. Both Karen and Dov were standing sentry duty. She returned to the command post bunker to find that Yordana had gone. She stretched out on the cot again and covered her legs with a blanket. The vision of the men inching down the mountainside came to her once more. The day had left her spent. She began to doze. The hours passed. Midnight. 1 o'clock. Kitty thrashed about on the cot. Her brain was filled with nightmare. She saw the horde of Cassie's men charging out at the column, shrieking with their sabers glinting. The guards were dead, and the Arabs had taken all the children and dug a huge pit for them. Kitty bolted up on the cot in a cold sweat, with her heart pounding madly. She shook her head slowly and trembled from head to foot. Then a sound reached her ears. She cocked her head and listened. Her eyes widened in terror. It was a sound of distant gunfire. She staggered to her feet. Yes. It was gunfire coming from the direction of Abu Yesha. It was no dream. The column had been discovered. Yordana entered the bunker just as Kitty rushed for the door.
Let me go, she shrieked.
Kitty, no, no.
They're killing my babies. Murderers, murderers.
Yordana exerted all her strength to pin Kitty to the wall, but Kitty was wild. She lashed out and tore from Yordana's grasp. The Sabra girl grabbed her, spun her around, and smashed her across the shoulders, sending her to the floor, sobbing.
Listen to me. That gunfire you hear is Zev Gilboa and the Palmach making a diversionary attack. They are hitting the opposite side of Abu Yesha to draw Cassie's men away from the convoy. You're lying. It is true. I swear it. I was told not to say anything until just before the attack. I came here and saw you asleep and went to warn the others.
Yordana knelt down and helped Kitty to her feet,
and led her to the cot.
There is a little brandy left. Drink it.
Kitty swallowed it, half gagging to force it down. She brought herself under control.
I am sorry that I struck you,
Jordana said.
No. You did the right thing.
Jordana sat beside Kitty and patted her hand and massaged the back of her neck. Kitty weakly lay her head on Jordana's shoulder and cried very softly until she had cried herself out. Then she stood up and put on her heavy clothing.
Karen and Dove will be coming off guard soon. I'll go to my bunker and make them some tea.
The hours of darkness dragged on and on. A night without end. Out in the blackness, the men crawled on their bellies past Abu Yisha, while the Palmach made its raid on the other side of the village. And then they plunged quickly down. Down. 2 o'clock. 3 o'clock. By now the waiters, even Jordana Ben Canaan, sat drained and empty in a dazed silence. At 5:15 they came out of the bunkers. The morning was icy. A thin, slick frost covered the center green. They all walked out of the main gate to that point where the lookout post hung over the edge of the mountain. The darkness faded from the land, and the lights in the valley went off one by one, as a musty gray dawn revealed the floor far below. The sentry looked through the field glasses for some sign of life down the mountain. There was nothing.
Look!
The sentry pointed. All of them stared toward the Yad El Moshav, where dots and dashes blinked out from a signal light.
What does it read? What does it mean?
It says X1416.
For a moment there was confusion. The message was repeated, X1416.
They are safe,
Jordana Ben Canaan said.
But lift thou up thy rod, and stretch out thine hand over the sea and divide it, and the children of Israel shall go on dry ground through the midst of the sea. Exodus 14:16.
She smiled exultantly at Kitty. Chapter 6. 4 days after the younger children of Gandafna had been evacuated, a series of reports filtered in to Ari. His settlement commanders were forwarding information that Arab pressure was lessening. When he learned from friends in Abu Yisha that Qasi had withdrawn half of the 100 men in the village and ordered them back to Fort Esther, Ari knew that the attack on Gandafna would come any day. Ari took 20 more Palmach troops, the last that could be spared anywhere in the Galilee, and once again made the mountain climb to Gandafna to assume personal command. He had 40 Palmach troops in all, around 30 staff and faculty members capable of fighting, and Jordana's Gadna youngsters, some 200 in number. His arsenal showed 150 antiquated rifles or homemade Sten guns, 2 machine guns, a few hundred homemade grenades, mines, and firebombs, and the obsolete Hungarian anti-tank gun with its 5 rounds of ammunition. Intelligence reports indicated that opposing him, Mohammed Qasi had 800 irregulars with unlimited ammunition and artillery support, plus perhaps another several hundred Arabs from Atta and other hostile villages along the Lebanese border. Ari's supply of ammunition was critical. He knew that when the attack did come, it had to be broken immediately. His one advantage was knowledge of the enemy. Mohammed Qasi, the Iraqi highway robber, had no formal military training. He was recruited by Kawukji on the promise of adventure and loot. Ari did not consider Qasi's men a particularly brave lot, but they could be whipped into a frenzy. If they ever got the upper hand during battle, they would become murderous. Ari planned to use Arab ignorance and lack of imagination as his allies. He banked his defensive plan on the presumption that Cassie would try a direct frontal assault in the straightest and shortest line from Fort Esther. The frontal attack had been the history of Arab irregulars' tactics since he began fighting them as a boy. He stacked his defenses in one place. The key spot in Ari's defense was a ravine that led like a funnel into Gandafna. If Ari could get Cassie to come into the ravine, he had a chance. Zev Gilboa kept patrols in the rocks and brush right outside Fort Esther to observe the Arab movements. He had confirmed the fact that Cassie was massing men. 3 days after Ari arrived at Gandafna, a young runner came into his command post with the news that Cassie's men, nearly 1,000 strong, had left the fort and were starting down the hill. Within 2 minutes, the black alarm was sounded, and every man, woman, and child at Gandafna took his post and stood by. A deep saddle in the mountains could cover Cassie's men until they arrived at a knoll directly over Gandafna, some 600 yards from the north side of the village and 200 yards from the critical ravine which led in like a funnel. Ari's men dug in to their prepared positions, became silent, and waited. Soon heads began popping up on the knoll. Within minutes, the point was swarming with irregulars. They stopped their progress and stared down at the ominously quiet village. The Arab officers were suspicious of the silence. Not a shot had been fired by either side. In the watch and gun tower atop Fort Esther, Mohammed Cassie looked through powerful field glasses and smiled as he saw his horde of men poised atop Gandafna. Since the Jews had not fired at them, his confidence grew that his men would be able to overrun the place. A cannon fired from the fort as a signal for the attack to begin. In Gandafna, they could hear harangues and conversation in Arabic as officers shouted at their men. Still, no one moved down from the knoll. The quiet from the village baffled them. More of them began to scream and point down at the village. Their curses and their anger rose in hysterical crescendo.
"They're trying to work themselves into a heroic lather," Ari said.
The disciplined forces of the Jews showed neither their faces nor their guns, though each man found it hard to remain controlled under the chilling abuse of the Arabs. After 20 minutes of ranting, there was a sudden eruption from the knoll as irregulars poured down with unearthly shrieks, sabers and bayonets flashing a steel silhouette against the sky. The first phase of Ari's defense would now receive a test. Each night he had sent patrols out to plant homemade landmines, which could be detonated from inside Gandafna. The mines formed a corridor and were so placed to compress the Arabs toward the middle of the ravine. Zev Gilboa, in the forwardmost position, waited until the Arab charge was in full fury. When the horde of men reached the minefield, Zev held up a green flag. Inside Gandafna, Ari set off the charges. 20 mines, 10 on each side, blew up at once. The roar shook the mountainside. The mines exploded on the fringe of the mob, which immediately squeezed together and rushed right down the funnel of the ravine. On the sides of the ravine, Ari had placed his 40 Palmach troops, the 2 machine guns, and all the grenades and firebombs in the arsenal. As the Arabs passed directly under them, the Palmach opened up a crossfire with the 2 guns and turned the ravine into a gory turkey shoot. Flames erupted from the firebombs and turned dozens of the irregulars into human torches, while the Palmach hurled a torrent of grenades among them. In addition, the Palmach set off strings of firecrackers, while from loudspeakers in the trees came a recording of bombing explosions. The continued din of the real and artificial arms was deafening and terrifying. Inside Fort Esther, Mohammed Cassie frantically called for artillery to clean off the sides of the ravine. The excited Arab gunners opened fire and landed half of their shells among their own men. Finally, they managed to silence 1 Palmach machine gun. The advance Arab force had been cut down like cordwood, but still they poured in. They had been stimulated to such frenzy that their thrust was now that of men insane with fear. The second machine gun stopped firing when its barrel burned out. The Palmach quit its position on the sides of the ravine and dropped back into Gandafna before the unabated onslaught. The Arabs' rush came to within 100 yards of the village in disorganized knots of screaming men. David Ben-Ami had the cover off the barricaded and sandbagged Hungarian anti-tank gun. The projectiles had been modified, and each of the 5 rounds now contained 2,000 shotgun pellets. If the gun worked properly, it would have the effect of a battery of men firing at once. The leading bunched mass of maddened Arabs rolled to within 50 yards, 40, 30, 20. The sweat poured down David Ben-Ami's face as he sighted the gun at point-blank range. 10 yards.
Fire one!
The ancient anti-tank gun bounced off the ground and spewed pellets into the faces of the chargers. Blood-curdling shrieks mingled with smoke, and through it, as he swiftly reloaded, David glimpsed piles of men lying dead or wounded within yards of the gun, and others staggering back in blind shock. The second wave came in behind the first.
Fire two!
The second wave went down in slaughter.
Fire three!
The barrel blew off the gun and she was finished. But she had done her work. In 3 shots, the buckshot canister sprays had dropped nearly 200 men. The momentum of the drive was halted. A last assault was tried. 100 Arabs again reached the edge of Gandafna, to be met by a broadside from Yordana Ben Canaan's entrenched Gadna youths. Bewildered and bleeding, the Arab survivors now scrambled back up the death-filled ravine. As they retreated, Zev Gilboa yelled out for the Palmach troops to follow him. The shepherd led his 40 fighters after several 100 running Arabs. He chased them back up the knoll and continued to pursue them. Ari looked through his field glasses.
The goddamned fool, Ari yelled. He's going to try to take Fort Esther. I told him to stop at the knoll.
What's the matter with Zev?
David grunted between his teeth.
Come on, Ari cried. Let's see if we can stop him.
Ari issued hasty orders for Yordana to have the Gadna children pick up the Arab arms in the field and pull back into Gandafna. His plan had paid off. In less than 15 minutes he had dissipated the strength of his defense, but nearly half Kasi's troops lay dead or wounded. When Mohammed Kasi saw his men run back up toward the fort, confusion broke out. Zev Gilboa was 25 yards out ahead of the rest of the Palmach when it happened. Arab gunners from Fort Esther began firing toward their own retreating men in order to stop the pursuing Palmach. Some of the Arabs managed to get inside Fort Esther. Those too close to the pursuing Jews were shut out and fired on. Zev had passed the outer accordions of barbed wire only 40 yards from the fort.
Cover!
He screamed at his troops. He threw himself flat and fired his Sten gun at the fort until the Palmach fell back out of range. Seeing that his attack was futile, Zev turned and tried to crawl back down the hill. A barrage of bullets came from the fort, and he was hit. He stood up and ran, and again he was hit, and this time he fell into the barbed wire and became entangled. He was unable to move. The Palmach had dug in and were preparing to go up to try to bring Zev out when Ari and David crawled up to them.
It's Zev. He's out there tangled up in the wire.
Ari looked out from behind a large rock. He was 100 yards away from Zev, across an open field. There were some places he could find cover behind large rocks, but close to Zev he would be fully exposed. Suddenly the firing from Fort Esther stopped, and it became very still.
What's going on?
David asked.
They're using Zev for bait. They see he can't move, and they hope we'll try to get up there and get him.
Those bastards. Why don't they shoot him and get it over with?
Can't you see, David? He's lost his rifle. They're going to wait until we leave and try to take him alive. They're going to take it out on him for all the men they lost today.
Oh, my God,
David groaned. He jumped out from cover, but Ari grabbed him and threw him back. Somebody give me a pair of grenades, Ari said. Good. David, take the troops back into Gandafna.
You're not going up there by yourself, Ari.
Do what I order, damn you. David turned quietly and signaled to start a withdrawal. He looked back to see Ari already scuttling up the hill toward Zev. The Arabs watched Ari move up. They knew someone would try to get the wounded man. They would wait until he got close enough and try to wound him too. Then the Jews would send another man up, and another. Ari got up, sprinted, and dived behind a rock. The Arabs did not shoot. Then he crawled again until he got to cover 20 yards from where Zev was tangled in the wire. Ari guessed that the Arabs would wait until he actually reached Zev and was an unmissable target. Get back! Zev called. Get back! Ari peeked around the boulder. He could see Zev clearly. The blood was spurting from his face and stomach. He was completely trapped in the wire. Ari looked up to Fort Esther. He could see the sun glint off the barrels of rifles trained on Zev. Get back! Zev shouted again. My guts are hanging out. I can't last 10 minutes. Get back! Ari slipped the hand grenades from his belt. Zev, I'm going to throw you some grenades, he called in German. Ari locked the pins in so they could not explode. He stood up quickly and threw both grenades to the boy. One landed just beside him. Zev picked up the grenade and held it close to his torn stomach. I've got it. Now get back. Ari ran down the hill quickly, catching the Arabs off guard. They had been expecting him to come up after Zev. When they opened fire, he was out of range and making his way toward Gandafna. Zev Gilboa was alone now, and the life was oozing from him. The Arabs waited for a half hour, watching for a trick, expecting a Jew to come up after him. They wanted him alive. The gates of Fort Esther opened. Some 30 Arabs emerged and trotted down to surround Zev. Zev twisted the pin out of the grenade, held it next to his head, and let the spoon fly off. Ari heard the blast and stopped. He turned chalky white, and his bad leg folded up under him. The insides of him shook. Then he continued crawling down to Gandafna. Ari sat in the command post bunker alone. His face was waxen, and only the trembling of his cheek muscles showed there was life in him. His eyes stared dully from black-ringed sockets. The Jews had lost 24 people, 11 Palmach boys, 3 Palmach girls, 6 faculty members, and 4 children. There were another 22 wounded. Mohammed Qasi had lost 418 men killed and 170 wounded. The Jews had taken enough weapons to make it likely that Qasi would never try another attack on Gandafna. But the Arabs still held Fort Esther and controlled the road through Abu Yesha. Kitty Fremont entered the bunker. She too was on the brink of exhaustion.
The Arab casualties have all been removed to Abu Yesha, except those you wanted for questioning.
Ari nodded. How about our wounded?
2 of the children don't look as though they'll make it. The rest will be all right. Here, I brought you some brandy, Kitty said.
Thanks. Thanks. Ari sipped and remained quiet.
I brought Zev Gilboa's things over to you. There isn't very much here. A few personal things.
A kibbutznik doesn't have very much of his own. Everything, including his life, belongs to something else, he said with a trace of irony.
I liked Zev, Kitty said. He was telling me last night how he looked forward to tending his sheep again. anyhow. His wife may want these things. She's having another baby, you know.
Zev was a damned fool, Ari snarled. He had no business trying to take that fort.
Ari picked up the handkerchief, filled with Zev's meager articles.
Lior is a good girl. She's tough. She'll come through it.
Ari threw the belongings into the kerosene stove.
I'll have a hard time replacing him.
Kitty's eyes narrowed.
Is that what you were thinking? You'd have a hard time replacing him?
Ari stood up and lit a cigarette.
You don't grow men like Zev on trees.
Is there nothing you cherish?
Tell me, Kitty. What did your husband's commander do when he was killed at Guadalcanal? Did he hold a wake for him?
I thought this was a little different, Ari. You've known Zeb since he was a boy. That girl, his wife, is a Yad El girl. She was raised two farms away from yours.
What do you want me to do?
Cry for that poor girl.
For a second, Ari's face twisted, and his lips trembled, and then his features sat rigidly.
It is nothing new to see a man die in battle. Get out of here.
Chapter 7 The siege of Sfat had begun exactly one day after the partition vote of November 29, 1947. When the British left Sfat in the spring of 1948, as expected, they handed the three key spots over to the Arabs. The police station, looking right down on the Jewish quarter, the Acropolis, commanding the entire city, and the Taggart Fort on Mount Canaan, just outside town. Sfat was shaped like an inverted cone. The Jewish quarter occupied a slice of about one-eighth of the cone, so that the Arabs were above, below, and on both sides of them. The Jews had only 200 half-trained Haganah men. Their refusal of evacuation and their decision to fight to the last man was in the spirit and tradition of the ancient Hebrews. The Kabbalists of Sfat, the least capable among the Jews of defending themselves, had been a primary target for the Mufti's riots. They had faced slaughter from Arab mobs before, and they had cringed. Now, they had made up their minds that they would stand and die. The Jewish quarter, jammed into the narrow, twisting lanes, sustained an amazing spirit. One day after the British left, Ari slipped Yoav Yarkoni into the Jewish quarter of Sfat with 30 Palmach boys and 20 Palmach girls. A wild celebration marked their arrival. It was the Sabbath, and Yarkoni's troops were exhausted from travel through hostile country, and they were hungry. For the first time in centuries, the Kabbalists broke the Sabbath by cooking a hot meal for the reinforcements. Kawukji, wanting to secure Sfat as the temporary capital for the Mufti, ordered the irregulars to overrun the Jewish quarter. The Arabs tried a few sorties and were thrown back out. They soon realized that they would take the quarter only by a house-by-house, room-by-room fight. They reconsidered and returned to sniping and siege tactics. The Jews were commanded by Remez and Yoav Yarkoni. Brigadier Sutherland had left his villa on Mount Canaan to become the only guest of Remez's resort hotel. He was called upon for advice now and then, but conceded that the Jews were doing quite well enough without his help. Remez took on as his first task the clearing of a definite field of fire. The Arab and Jewish quarters were jammed up against each other, making it easy for Arab patrols to slip through and spread his already thin defensive strength. He wanted space between his forces and the Arabs. Yarkoni took a crew into the Arab quarters, seized a dozen borderline houses, and began shooting from them. Then he withdrew. Each time the Arabs came back, Yarkoni would again attack and take the same borderline houses. Finally, the Arabs dynamited the houses to keep the Jews from using them. It was exactly what Remez wanted. It created the space between the two sectors to give the Jews better visibility and easier defense. With this accomplished, Remez and Yarkoni devised the second tactic. Yarkoni set out to harass the Arabs around the clock. Each day he sent 3 or 4 Palmach patrols into the Arab sector to move through the maze of alleys or over the rooftops. His patrols would suddenly make a sharp, hit-and-run attack, each time at a different place. Whenever the Arabs concentrated their men in one strong point, the Jews were informed of it by spies and thus knew exactly where to strike and what spot to avoid. Like a jabbing boxer, the daylight patrols kept the Arabs off balance. But it was the night patrols of the Palmach that drove the Arabs into a frenzy. Yarkoni had lived in Morocco, and he knew his enemy. The Arab was a superstitious man, with an unnatural fear of the dark. Yarkoni used the darkness like extra troops. The Palmach night patrols, merely by shooting off firecrackers, kept the Arab population in a panic. Remez and Yarkoni admitted that their tactics were desperation measures. They were not strong enough to do real damage to the enemy, and the sheer weight of Arab numbers, position, and arms began to grind them down. A lost Palmach or Haganah soldier could not be replaced. Food was almost as difficult to replace. Ammunition was so critical that fines were levied against any Haganah or Palmach soldier who wasted a bullet. Even as they were being worn down, the Jews held every inch of their quarter, and the amazing spirit never flagged. A single radio receiver was by now their only daily contact with the outside world. Yet schools continued on schedule, the small newspaper never skipped an edition, and the pious did not miss a minute of synagogue. Letters got out by the patrols were fixed with hand-drawn stamps and were honored throughout Palestine by the Yishuv. The siege carried on through the winter and the spring. Finally, one day, Yarkoni met with Sutherland and Remez to face bitter reality. The Jews had lost 50 of their best fighting men. They were down to their last 12 bags of flour, and they did not have ammunition to last 5 days. Yarkoni did not even have firecrackers for his patrols. The Arabs had sensed this weakness and were becoming bolder.
"I promised Ari that I wouldn't bother him with our troubles, but I am afraid I must get to Ein Ohr and talk to him," Yarkoni decided. The same night, he slipped out of Sfat and went to Ari's headquarters.
Yoav reported in full on the Sfat situation. He concluded,
"I hate to bother you, Ari, but in another 3 days we are going to have to start eating rats."
Ari grunted. The stand at Sfat had been an inspiration to the entire Yishuv. It was more than a strategic position now. It was another invaluable symbol of defiance.
"If we could win Sfat, we could crush Arab morale in the whole Galilee. Ari, every time we have to fire a bullet, we must go into a debate about it."
"I have an idea," Ari said. "Come with me."
Ari set up an emergency night patrol to get at least some supplies of food into Sfat, and then took Yoav to the ordnance shed. In an inner room, he showed the Moroccan a strange-looking contraption of cast iron, nuts, and bolts.
"What the hell is it?" Yoav asked.
"Yoav, you are looking at a Davidka."
"A Davidka?"
"Yes, a little David, handcrafted by Jewish genius."
Yoav scratched his jaw. In some respects, one might say it did appear to be a weapon, of a sort, yet nothing quite like it existed anywhere else, Yoav was sure.
"What is it supposed to do?"
"I'm told that it shoots mortar shells."
"How?"
"Damned if I know. We haven't experimented yet. I have a report from Jerusalem saying that it has been very effective."
"For the Jews or Arabs?"
"Yoav, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I've been saving this weapon for the proper situation. It's yours. Take it to Sfat."
Yoav walked around the odd piece of machinery.
"The things we have to resort to win a war," he mumbled.
The night patrol carrying emergency rations into Sfat also brought along the Davidka and 30 pounds of ammunition. As soon as he arrived, Yoav called the Haganah and Palmach leaders together, and through the rest of the night they traded ideas on how the thing was supposed to work. 10 people were present, and 10 opinions were given. At last, someone thought of sending for Brigadier Sutherland. He was awakened at the hotel and half-dragged to headquarters. He stared at the Davidka in disbelief. "Only a Jew could concoct something like this," he concluded. "I hear it was very effective in Jerusalem," Yoav apologized. Sutherland played with all the levers and handles and switches and sights, and in the next hour they evolved a firing procedure which might, or might not, work. The next morning, the Davidka was carried to a clearing and pointed in the general direction of the Arab-held police station and some nearby houses the Arabs used as sniping posts. The Davidka's ammunition was no less strange in appearance than the Davidka. It was shaped like a mallet, of which the head was an iron cylinder filled with dynamite equipped with detonators. The thick handle allegedly fit down the mortar tube. On firing, the handle was supposed to be thrust out with such force that it would hurl the whole unbalanced load of dynamite at the target. Sutherland had visions of the thing flying for a few feet and exploding in front of them. "If that warhead merely falls out of the end of the tube, as I confidently expect," Sutherland said, "we are likely to lose the entire Jewish population of Sfat." "Then I suggest we rig up a long line so we can fire it from a safe distance," Remes said. "How do we aim it?" Yarkoni asked. "Aiming this monstrosity isn't going to do much good. Just point it in the general direction and pray for the best." The chief rabbi and many of the Kabbalists and their wives gathered around the Davidka and carried on a lengthy debate on whether or not it meant doomsday for all of them. Finally, the chief rabbi said special benedictions over the weapon and asked the Messiah kindly to spare them, for they had indeed been very good in keeping the laws. "Well, let's get it over with," Remes said pessimistically. The Kabbalists backed to safety. Firing caps were stuffed down the tube, and one of the shells was lifted and the long handle placed inside. The cylinder of dynamite balanced over the end of the tube threateningly. A long line was attached to the firing mechanism. Everyone took cover, and the earth stood still. "Let her go," Yarkoni ordered in a shaky voice. Remes jerked, and a strange thing happened. The little David fired. The handle hissed out of the tube, and the bucket of dynamite arched and spun handle over bucket up the hill. As it hurled through the air, growing smaller and smaller, it made a hideous swishing sound. It crashed into some Arab houses near the police station. Sutherland's mouth hung open. Yarkoni's mustache went from down to up. Remes's eyes popped out. The old Kabbalists stopped praying long enough to look in astonishment. The shell exploded like a thunderclap, shaking the town to its foundations. It seemed as though half the hillside must have been blown away. After moments of stunned silence, there was an eruption of shouting and hugging and kissing and praying and jubilation. "By Jove," was all Sutherland could say. "By Jove." The Palmachniks formed a horror ring and danced around the little David. "Come on, come on, let's fire another round." In the Arab quarters they could hear the Jews cheering, and the Arabs knew why. The very sound of the flying bomb in itself was enough to frighten one to death, to say nothing of the explosion. No one, Palestinian Arabs or irregulars, had bargained for anything like this. Each time the little David fired, a scene of havoc followed. The Arabs quaked in terror as the Jews revenged some of the 100 years of torment. Yoav Yarkoni got word to Ari that the Davidka had the Arabs in a turmoil. Ari sensed an opportunity and decided on a risky attempt to exploit it. He took a few men from each settlement and was able to scrape together 2 companies of Haganah. He got them into Sfat at night with more ammunition for the Davidka. Swish!
Boom!
The bucket of bolts and its hissing bomb was devastating the town.
Swish! Boom!
The third day after the Davidka had come to Svat, the skies opened and it poured rain. Ari Ben Kanan then made the greatest bluff of the war that counted bluffs as part of the arsenal. He had Remez call all the Arab spies together, and he gave them a briefing.
In case you didn't know, brothers, Ari addressed them in Arabic, we have a secret weapon. I am not at liberty to disclose the nature of the weapon, but I might say that you all know that it always rains after a nuclear blast. Need one say more?
Within minutes, the spies spread the word that the little David was a secret weapon. Within an hour, every Arab mouth in Svat had repeated the appalling news.
The Jews have the atom bomb. Swish! Boom!
The little David roared, and the rain turned to a deluge, and the panic was on. Inside of 2 hours, the roads out of Svat were clogged with fleeing Arabs. Ari Ben Kanan led the Haganah on an attack with 300 men. The attack was more spontaneous than calculated, and Ari's men were thrown off the Acropolis by irregulars and a handful of angry Svat Arabs. He lost heavily, but the Svat population continued to run. 3 days later, with Svat nearly empty of Arab civilian population, and with hundreds of the irregulars deserted, Ari Ben Kanan, Remez, and Yoav Yarkoni led a better-planned three-pronged attack and took the Acropolis. The tables were turned. The Jews were on the high ground above the Arab police station. Now those who had for decades tormented and murdered the Kabbalists in wild mobs had their chance to stand and fight, but they fled in the face of the Jewish wrath. The police station fell, and Ari immediately headed outside of the town to block off the huge Taggart fort on Mount Canaan, the strongest of the Arab positions. When he arrived, he was astounded to discover that the Arabs had abandoned the Taggart fort, a position it would have been impossible to take. With the fort in his hands, the conquest of Svat was complete. The victory of Svat was staggering. The vulnerable position thought impossible to defend had not only been defended, but the defenders had conquered the city with a few hundred fighters and a weird weapon called the Little David. There were many theories and much discussion on just how this victory came about. Even the Kabbalists of Svat were split on the subject. Rabbi Chaim of the Ashkenazim, or European school, was quite certain of divine intervention as foretold in Job.
When he is about to fill his belly, God shall cast the fury of his wrath upon him, and shall rain it upon him while he is eating. He shall flee from the iron weapon.
Rabbi Meir, of the Sephardic or Oriental school, disputed Chaim, and was just as certain of divine intervention as described in Ezekiel.
Thy walls shall shake at the noise. He shall enter into thy gates, as men enter into a city wherein is made a breach. Thy strong garrison shall go down to the ground.
Bruce Sutherland returned to his villa on Mount Canaan. The Arabs had desolated it. They had trampled his lovely rose garden to the earth, and they had stolen everything, including the doorknobs. It did not matter to Sutherland, for it would all be rebuilt again. He and Yarkoni and Remez walked out to his rear patio and looked over the valley to Svat. They drank a lot of brandy, and they began to chuckle. Neither they nor anyone else was aware of it yet, but the stampede of Svat's population had opened a new and tragic chapter. It began the creation of Arab refugees. Somewhere in the Galilee, an obsolete Liberator bomber, piloted by a volunteer crew of South Africans and Americans, looked to the earth for a pair of blue flares. The flares were spotted, and they landed the bomber blind, with only a few flashlights marking the airfield. The plane bumped harshly over a pitted runway and skidded to a stop. The motors were cut quickly. Swarms of people engulfed the plane and emptied it of its cargo, the first shipment of modern arms. Rifles, machine guns, mortars, and hundreds of thousands of rounds of ammunition were snatched from its waist and tail sections and its converted bomb bays. The working parties stripped the Liberator clean in minutes. They loaded up a dozen trucks, which scattered in as many different directions. In a dozen kibbutzim, Gadna youths stood ready to clean the weapons and get them out to the embattled settlements. The plane was turned and made a hair's breadth takeoff and flew back to Europe to get another load of arms. In the morning, British troops came to investigate Arab complaints that they had heard an airplane landing in the area. The British were unable to find a single trace of a plane and were certain the Arab imagination was being carried away again. By the time the fourth and fifth shipment of arms arrived, the Jews began to roll up victories. Tiberias on the Sea of Galilee had fallen to the Jews. The huge Gesher Taggart fort was grabbed by the Jews and held off repeated attacks by Iraqi irregulars. With the fall of Sfat, the Jews launched their first coordinated offensive, Operation Iron Broom, to sweep Galilee clean of hostile villages. Iron Broom was led by machine gun-bearing jeeps, which blazed into the villages and stampeded the Arabs. Sfat had started a crack in Arab morale that gave Iron Broom a psychological jump. With a score of local victories behind them, and the knowledge that they could mount a successful offensive, the Haganah went after the vital port of Haifa. The Haganah swept down the slopes of Mount Carmel in a four-pronged attack, each action aimed at an Arab strongpoint. The Arab troops, consisting of home guards, Syrian, Lebanese, and Iraqi irregulars, mounted a strong defense and were at first able to contain the battle. The British, who still controlled the dock area, called truce after truce to stop the Jewish offenses, and at times took away hard-won vantage points. The Arabs continued to hold well against the steady Jews.